Welcome to another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word. Please open to Acts chapter number 19, where we will begin at verse 21 in just one moment. Last session, we finished Paul's first letter to the Corinthians, and soon we will be diving into his second letter to that same group. Something happens between 1 Corinthians being finished and 2 Corinthians being started. And that is a great big riot at Ephesus. Now, we know that when Paul wrote his first letter, his intention was to stick around at Ephesus until Pentecost time. Now, I suspect that his first letter was written right around the time of Pentecost. So his anticipation was he was going to stick around for about another 7 weeks, and then he would head north past Troas, up into Macedonia, and then swing to the south and west, down into Achaia, and he planned on spending probably the winter months in Corinth itself. So all that is laid out in some form or fashion in 1 Corinthians. And here in Acts chapter 19, you can see him preparing for that. Acts 19, 21. Now, after these events, Paul resolved in the Spirit to pass through Macedonia and Achaia and then to go to Jerusalem. And he was saying, after I've been there, I must also see Rome. So he's already got his Roman visit on his mind as he's writing 1 Corinthians in the very early part of 57. And he prepares for this last sweep through Macedonia and Achaia so that he can go back to Jerusalem, deliver some of the financial support there, and then give a report probably to the church up at Antioch, and then head off to Rome. Verse 22 says, having sent them into Macedonia, these two helpers, Timothy and Erastus, he himself stayed in Asia for a while. So that while is probably at least part of the time immediately after he wrote the book of 1 Corinthians. More than likely, we're talking in the few weeks following Passover. And then everything blows up. Verse 23 says, about that time, there arose no little disturbance concerning the way. Now, that is the Jewish name for the church. It's certainly tied in with Jesus' own comments, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except by me. But there's also Old Testament passages predicting the coming of the Messiah, which called people to stay on the way of God, on the path of God, and to make his way, that is the coming of Jesus, coming of Messiah, his way clear. So this is the way that Paul refers to the church. Verse 24, for a man named Demetrius, a silversmith who made silver shrines of Artemis, brought no little business to the craftsmen. So we are introduced to a Greek named fellow living there at Ephesus. He is a silversmith. And he specializes in making little souvenir shrines of the Artemis image, or maybe the Artemis temple building, that religious tourists can take home with them after a visit to the shrine building of Artemis and after seeing the image of Artemis. Artemis was the goddess of the hunt for the region around Ephesus. And the story seems to be that perhaps a meteorite fell near the city of Ephesus at some point in the past, and the people picked this meteorite up and somehow began to associate it with Artemis, and placed it and perhaps another image into the temple, and that brought even more tourists in. So Artemis and a whole bunch of the other people associated with religious tourist trade, they gather together. Verse 25, these he gathered together with the workmen in similar trades. And he said, men, you know that from this business we have our wealth. So it's not surprising. You see this if you go anywhere where there's religious tourism. There's always people trying to sell you stuff. On my trips to Israel, I'm always being offered opportunities to buy religious souvenirs. When we went to Bethlehem, we went to a Christian-owned gift shop. And it was chock-a-block with all sorts of beautiful carved olive wood decorations and Christmas things and nativities and all of that. And the people there were definitely wanting me to buy some, or wanting me to buy stuff on behalf of my church. And so that's just normal when you have a religious site. And so in this case, these guys are just acknowledging that. We make our money from the religious tourism trade related to the temple of Artemis. Verse 26, you see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying that gods made with hands are not gods. Now, we will discover later that Paul is not specifically attacking Artemis or the worship of Artemis. He is generically teaching that there is one true God who made heaven and earth, and that gods formed out of stone and silver and wood and gold and whatever else, these man-made things cannot represent the true and living God, and that you need to embrace the one who is real. And people are doing exactly that. And when they're doing it, they're leaving behind their idolatry. They're leaving behind their connection to carved images, and they're also leaving behind buying religious tourist objects associated with the goddess Artemis or any of the other gods and goddesses that are worshipped here in Ephesus. And so it's not just simply hitting the religious tourist trade at Ephesus. Paul, you know, is already teaching and establishing through that teaching the other churches in Asia province. And so it's spreading all around the region, and they're concerned about this. Verse 27, there is danger, not only that this trade of ours may come into disrepute. So not only are we going to get hit in the pocketbook, but remember, they are religious. It says, also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis may be counted as nothing, and that she may even be deposed from her magnificence, she whom all of Asia and the world worship. So he first lays out for them, this is not good for us financially. We're already seeing a downtrend in the purchase of little silver shrines of the goddess Artemis or of her temple. But even worse than a downturn in our economy is the fact she may be disrespected. She may be abandoned. She may lose her worshipers. And at least some of these guys are quite sincere in their religion focused on Artemis. And so they get all hyped up about defending their goddess. Verse 28, when they heard this, they were enraged and they were crying out, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" And so they started chant, "Great is Artemis! Great is Artemis! Great is Artemis!" And then the whole city was filled with the confusion. And they rushed together into the theater, and they were dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians who were Paul's companions in travel. So they apparently have some sense of where Paul and his entourage would be. And they get their little mini riot, their little mini celebration for Artemis going down the street. And they go to the place where they expect to find Paul, but they don't find him. Somehow he's somewhere else. So they do grab a couple of guys that they know are associated with Paul, and they take them to the theater. Now, why do they take them there? The theater is where theatrical presentations are made. It's where poetry readings happen and things of that nature. But it is also the place where the ecclesia meets. Now, ecclesia means the called out ones. And it was the reference to the assembly of the voting members of the city. Remember, this is in an area where democracy is practiced. And so every free citizen, we're pretty much going to be talking about the males in these areas, can be called into assembly to talk about things that are important to the polis, that is, the city. And they can make judgment calls as a group. They can take votes. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to get the whole democratic assembly together to deal with this crisis that's attacking their economy and their local faith. And so they've got a couple of Paul's friends and companions here. Verse number 30. When Paul wished to go in among the crowd, the disciples would not let him. So Paul finds out about it, wherever it was he was at. He now discovers there's something big going on. So he shows up at the theater. He wants to go in and address the crowd, make some sort of defense, some sort of apology. That is the technical term for a defense for what's been going on. But the believers in Jesus here, the fellow Christians with Paul, they don't want to risk it. This crowd is looking kind of ugly, and they don't want to take a chance with him. It says in verse 31 that even some of the Asiarchs would be those who are in leadership for the region. The region is called Asia Province, and so these are the guys that take care of business. They're at the top of this democratic structure. And they've apparently become friends of Paul. Some of them may have been converted to the belief in Jesus. And it says, even some of the Asiarchs who were friends of his sent to him, and they were urging him not to venture into the theater. Apparently, they're already in the theater because they need to take control of this problem. They need to lead this mob away from the violence that they're getting ready for. And so they send a message out to Paul, don't you dare come in here. You stay outside. Let us take care of it. Now, inside the theater, verse 32, some cried out one thing, some another, for the assembly was in confusion, and most of them didn't even know why they'd come together. So this happens, all of us know. Once a mob kind of gets started, sooner or later, people get sucked into it that are only along for the ride. They're not really interested in what started it. They're only interested in breaking windows and smashing things and grabbing loot and going on with their life. And so some of the people are totally out of the loop to understand what started this. Verse 33, some of the crowd prompted Alexander, whom the Jews had put forward, and Alexander motioned with his hand, wanting to make a defense to the crowd. Now, it's interesting to me, what's likely going on here is what's happened at other places where Paul's ministry is about to come to a conclusion. Remember, he always goes into a place, starts at the synagogue, and he preaches to those who are best prepared to hear the gospel, the Jewish people and the proselytes. And he keeps doing that until he's reached the saturation point where every Jewish person, every Jewish proselyte in the area has already made their mind up one way or the other about Jesus. And then he will leave the synagogue and he'll go out into the Gentile world and start talking to them out in the agora, out in the marketplace, and in the schools and things like that. And then he will keep that up until objection to him preaching and teaching reaches a fever pitch. And often the group that brings that to a head would be the local Antichrist Jewish element. And I use that in its most technical sense. The Jewish people who are against the message of Jesus as the Christ. They don't care that Jesus was Jewish. They don't care that Paul is Jewish. All they care about is they don't want that cultish stuff being taught here because that's their mindset. So I believe it's likely that Alexander and the Jewish people that don't believe in Jesus as Messiah have seen this gathering crowd as an opportunity to put all the blame on Paul and get him run out of town, because that's worked in other places. But they run into a bit of a problem. Verse 34, when they recognized that he, Alexander, was a Jew, for about 2 hours they all cried out with one voice, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians!" So some of the people realize the guy that's trying to wave to get it quiet so he can talk to us, he doesn't even believe in Artemis. He's a Jewish guy. Why would we let him talk to us? And so they just start this religious chant, and it goes on for a couple of hours until finally the officials have to do something about it. Because you see, they're not meeting here as the democratic assembly of the called out ones. They're just a riot happening in the theater. They're just chanting. And so verse 35, when the town clerk had quieted the people. Now the town clerk is the guy that has all the official records as to who the citizens are that have the right to vote in a public assembly like this. He's the one probably that keeps the record of the meeting and of the votes that take place. He's the policy guy and the recorder. And so he is very concerned that this is not being done properly, that this is out of hand. So he gets up, probably motions with his hand as well. Everybody calm down. Everybody sit down. Just listen up. And we're talking about tens of thousands of people that have probably gathered into this theater. He gets them all quiet and he addresses them. Men of Ephesus, who is there who does not know that the city of the Ephesians is temple keeper of the great Artemis and of the sacred stone that fell from the sky? So that helps us, doesn't it? He says, there's not anyone anywhere that doesn't understand that Ephesus is where the temple of Artemis is, and that the temple of Artemis is where the great sky image is enshrined. That's why people come here. Verse 36, seeing then that these things cannot be denied, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rash. So you guys need to calm down. For you have brought these men here who are neither sacrilegious nor blasphemers of our goddess. So he jerks him into reality. He says, you've drug a couple of guys here, and you're all upset about another guy somewhere else. And they haven't done anything illegal. They haven't gone on in and defaced the great sky image. They haven't gone in and destroyed any of the sacred items in the temple. They haven't defaced the temple property. They've done nothing sacrilegious at all. And they're not going around talking down about Artemis specifically. They're not treating her with disrespect in a public forum, which tells us a little bit something about Paul's approach. He tries to keep things open enough that he can engage people. Remember when he was writing that he tries to be all things to all people in order to win all, to win some of all these different groups? It would not do him any good to get in your face and talk nasty about Artemis to these people that believe in her. And so he hasn't. He's talked about the true and living God. He's talked about Jesus, the Son of God, and he's talked perhaps generically about the fact that everybody understands that idols are man-made, and that doesn't seem to make good sense that you'd bow down to a man-made object. But he's not blasphemed Artemis specifically. And this guy knows that. And he says, all of you know that that's the case. He hasn't been these guys have not been sacrilegious, and they haven't been blasphemers. Verse number 38. If therefore Demetrius, remember he was the guy that started all this. If Demetrius and the craftsmen with him have a complaint against anyone, the courts are open. There are proconsuls. See, that's the typical day-by-day mechanism for judicial resolution. You don't call a great big assembly of the people. You go to the court system and work it out. And that's what he's saying. You guys have not followed procedure. So let them bring charges against one another. But if you seek anything further, it shall be settled in the regular assembly. They had regular meetings of the larger democratic assembly where they talked about local events and policies and took votes. And he says, you guys need to either take it to court or you wait till the next assembly. Verse 40, for we really are in danger of being charged with rioting today, since there is no cause that we can give to justify this commotion. The Romans as a whole tried to keep the peace, and they expected the locals, the local government, to assist in that. And if the local government could not keep their own people from rioting, the Romans from higher up in the chain would say, it's time for a change of leadership. And so that's what this guy's concerned about, is that he and other local leaders are going to get charged with not being able to keep the peace. Now, all this sounds pretty reasonable, apparently. So when he had said these things, he dismissed the assembly, told them all go home. And then after the uproar had ceased, Paul sent for the disciples, and after encouraging them, he said farewell, and he departed for Macedonia. So apparently, Paul is going to be just a few weeks ahead of his intended schedule because of this riot. Now, nobody got hurt as far as we can tell. So Paul is going to leave because of the pressure of the moment. But the fact of the matter is, he was getting ready to leave anyway. And so when we come together next session, we will be looking at the second letter of Corinthians, because it tells us of his itinerary. He leaves here, Ephesus, and goes to Troas, ministers there for a little while, and then heads to Macedonia. And it is from Macedonia that he writes his second letter to the Corinthian church.